Chapter 3. Charles Freck, too, had been thinking about visiting New Path. The freak out of Jerry Fabin had gotten to him that much. Seated with Jim Barris in the Fiddler's Three coffee shop in Santa Ana, he fooled around with his sugar-glazed donut morosely.
That's a heavy decision, he said. That's cold turkey, they do. They just keep with you night and day so you don't snuff yourself or bite off your arm. But they never give you anything, like a doctor will prescribe. Valium, for instance.
Chuckling, Barris inspected his patty melt, which was melted imitation cheese and fake ground beef on special organic bread.
What kind of bread is this? He asked. Look on the menu, Charles Freck said, and explained.
If you go in, Barris said, you'll experience symptoms that emanate up from the basic fluids of the body, specifically those located in the brain. By that I refer to the catecholamines, such as noradrenaline and serotonin. You see, it functions this way. Substance D, in fact all addictive dope, but substance D most of all, interacts with the catecholamines in such a fashion that involvement is locked in place at a subcellular level. Biological counter-adaptation has occurred, and in a sense, forever. He ate a huge bite of the right half of his patty melt. They used to believe this occurred only with the alkaloid narcotics, such as heroin.
Oh, I never shot smack. That's a downer.
The waitress, foxy and nice in her yellow uniform with pert boobs and blonde hair, came over to their table.
Hi, she said. Is everything all right?
Charles Freck gazed up in fear. Is your name Patty? Barris asked her, signaling to Charles Freck that it was cool.
No,
she pointed to the name badge on her right boob.
It's Beth.
I wonder what the left one's called, Charles Freck thought.
The waitress we had last time was named Patty, Barris said, eyeing the waitress grossly. Same as the sandwich.
Well, that must have been a different Patty from the sandwich. I think she spells it with an I. Everything is super good, Barris said.
Over his head, Charles Freck could see a thought balloon in which Beth was stripping off her clothes and moaning to be banged.
Not with me, Charles Freck said. I got a lot of problems no one else has.
In a somber voice, Barris said, more people than you'd think, and more each day. This is a world of illness and getting progressively worse. Above his head, the thought balloon got worse, too.
Would you like to order dessert? Beth asked, smiling down at them.
What like? Charles Freck said with suspicion.
We have fresh strawberry pie and fresh peach pie, Beth said, smiling, that we make here ourselves.
No, we don't want any dessert, Charles Freck said.
The waitress left.
That's for old ladies, he said to Barris, those fruit pies.
The idea of turning yourself over for rehabilitation, Barris said, certainly makes you apprehensive. That's a manifestation of purposeful negative symptoms, your fear. It's the drug talking. To keep you out of New Path and keep you from getting off it, you see, all symptoms are purposeful, whether they are positive or negative.
Not a shit, Charles Freck muttered.
The negative ones show up as the cravings, which are deliberately generated by the total body to force its owner, which in this case is you, to search frantically.
The first thing they do to you when you go into New Path, Charles Freck said, is to cut off your pecker as an object lesson, and then they fan out in all directions from there.
Your spleen next, Barris said.
Are they what? They cut? Yeah, what does that do, a spleen?
Helps you digest your food.
How?
By removing the cellulose from it.
Oh, then I guess after that...
Just non-cellulose foods, no leaves or alfalfa.
Why, how long can you live that way?
Barris said, it depends on your attitude.
How many spleens does the average person have?
He knew that there were usually two kidneys. Depends on his weight and age.
Why?
Charles Freck felt keen suspicion. A person grows more spleens over the years. By the time he's 80...
You're shitting me.
Barris laughed.
Always he'd been a strange laugher, Charles Freck thought. An unreal laugh, like something breaking.
Why your decision, Barrett said presently, to turn yourself in for residence therapy at a drug rehab center?
Jerry Fabian, he said.
With a gesture of easy dismissal, Barrett said, Jerry was a special case. I once watched Jerry Fabian staggering around and falling down, shitting all over himself, not knowing where he was, trying to get me to look up and research what poison he'd got hold of. Thallium sulfate, most likely. It's used in insecticides and to snuff rats. It was a burn, somebody panging back. I could think of 10 different toxins and poisons that might...
Is another reason, Charles Freck said. I'm running low again in my supply, and I can't stand it. It's always running low and not knowing if I'm fucking ever going to see anymore.
Well, we can't even be sure we'll see another sunrise.
But, shit, I'm down so low now that it's like a matter of days. And also, I think I'm being ripped off. I can't be taking them that fast. Somebody must be pilfering from my fucking stash.
How many tabs do you drop a day?
That's very difficult to determine, but not that many.
A tolerance builds up, you know.
Sure, right, but not like that. I can't stand running out and like that. On the other hand,
he reflected,
I think I got a new source. That chick, Donna, something.
Oh, Bob's girl.
His old lady, Charles Freck said, nodding.
No, he never got into her pants. He tries to.
Is she reliable?
Which way? As a lay, or... Barris gestured, hand to mouth and swallowing.
What kind of sex is that?
Then he flashed on it.
Oh, yeah, the latter.
Fairly reliable, scatterbrained, somewhat. Like you'd expect with a chick, especially the darker ones. Has her brain between her legs, like most of them. Probably keeps her stash there, too. He chuckled. Her old dealer's stash. Charles Freck leaned toward him.
Arctur never bawled Donna? He talks about her like he did.
Barris said, That's Bob Arctur. Talks like he did many things. Not the same, not at all.
Well, how come he never laid her? Well, can he get it on?
Barris reflected wisely, still fiddling with his patty melt. He'd now torn it into little bits. Donna has problems. Possibly she's on junk. Her aversion to bodily contact in general. Junkies lose interest in sex, you realize, due to their organs swelling up from vasoconstriction. And Donna, I've observed, shows an inordinate failure of sexual arousal to an unnatural degree, not just toward Arctur, but toward... He paused grumpily. Other males as well.
Shit, you just mean she won't come across.
She would, Barris said, if she were handled right. For instance, he glanced up in a mysterious fashion. I can show you how to lay her for 98 cents.
Why, I don't want to lay her. I just want to buy from her.
He felt uneasy. There was perpetually something about Barris that made his stomach uncomfortable.
Why 98 cents? He said. She wouldn't take money. She's not turning tricks. Anyhow, she's Bob's chick.
The money wouldn't be paid directly to her, Barris said in his precise, educated way. He leaned toward Charlie Freck, pleasure and guile quivering amid his hairy nostrils. And not only that, the green tint of his shades had steamed up. Donna does coke. Anybody who would give her a gram of coke, she'd undoubtedly spread her legs for, especially if certain rare chemicals were added in strictly scientific fashion that I've done painstaking research on.
I wish you wouldn't talk that way, Charles Freck said. About her. Anyhow, a gram of coke selling now for over $100. Who's got that?
Half sneezing, Barris declared, I can derive a gram of pure cocaine at a total cost to me for the ingredients from which I get it, not including my labor, of less than $1.
Bullshit.
I'll give you a demonstration.
Where do these ingredients come from?
The 7-Eleven store, Barris said, and stumbled to his feet, discarding bits of patty melt in his excitement. Get the check, he said, and I'll show you. I've got a temporary lab set up at the house until I can create a better one. You can watch me extract a gram of cocaine from common legal materials purchased openly at the 7-Eleven food store for under $1 total cost. He started down the aisle. Come on.
His voice was urgent.
Sure,
Charles Freck said, picking up the check and following. The mother's dingy, he thought. Or maybe he isn't. With all those chemistry experiments he does and reading at the county library, maybe there's something to it. Think of the profit, he thought. Think what we could clear. He hurried after Barris, who was getting out the keys to his Carmen Ghia as he strode in his surplus flyer's jumpsuit past the cashier. They parked in the lot of the 7-Eleven, got out, and walked inside. As usual, a huge dumb cop stood pretending to read a strokebook magazine at the front counter. In actuality, Charles Freck knew, he was checking out everyone who entered to see if they were intending to hit the place.
What do we pick up here?
He asked Barris, who was casually strolling about the aisles of stacks of food. A spray can, Barris said, of solar cane.
Sunburn spray.
Charles Freck did not really believe this was happening, but on the other hand,
who knew? Who could be sure?
He followed Barris to the counter. This time, Barris paid. They purchased the can of solar cane and then made it past the cop and back to their car. Barris drove rapidly from the lot down the street on and on at high speed, ignoring posted speed limit signs until finally he rolled to a halt before Bob Arctor's house, with all the old unopened newspapers in the tall grass of the front yard. Stepping out, Barris lifted some items with wires dangling from the back seat to carry indoors.
Voltmeter, Charles Freck saw,
and other electronic testing gear and a soldering gun.
What's that for?
He asked.
I've got a long and arduous job to do, Barris said, carrying the various items plus the solar cane up the walk to the front door.
He handed Charles Freck the door key.
And I'm probably not getting paid, as is customary.
Charles Freck unlocked the door and they entered the house. Two cats and a dog rattled at them, making hopeful noises. He and Barris carefully edged them aside with their boots. At the rear of the dinette, Barris had, over the weeks, laid out a funky lab of sorts. Bottles and bits of trash here and there, worthless-looking objects he had filched from different sources. Barris, Charles Freck knew, from having to hear about it, believed not so much in thrift as in ingenuity. You should be able to use the first thing that came to hand to achieve your objective, Barris preached. A thumbtack, a paperclip, part of an assembly, the other part of which was broken or lost. It looked to Charles Freck as if a rat had set up shop here, was performing experiments with what a rat prized. The first move in Barris's scheme was to get a plastic bag from the roll by the sink and squirt the contents of the spray can into it, on and on until the can, or at least the gas, was exhausted.
This is unreal, Charles Freck said. Super unreal.
What they have deliberately done, Barris said cheerfully as he labored, is mix the cocaine with oil so that it can't be extracted. But my knowledge of chemistry is such that I know precisely how to separate the coke from the oil. He had begun vigorously shaking salt into the gummy slime in the bag. Now he poured it all into a glass jar. I'm freezing it, he announced, grinning, which causes the cocaine crystals to rise to the top since they are lighter than air. Than the oil, I mean. And then the terminal step, of course, I keep to myself, but it involves an intricate methodological process of filtering. He opened the freezer above the refrigerator and carefully placed the jar inside.
How long will it be in there? Charles Freck asked.
Half an hour. Barris got out one of his hand-rolled cigarettes, lit it, then strolled over to the heap of electronic testing equipment. He stood there meditating, rubbing his bearded chin.
Yeah, Charles Freck said, but, I mean, so even if you get a whole gram of pure coke out of this, I can't use it on Donna to, you know, get in her pants in exchange. It's like buying her. That's what it amounts to.
Exchange, Barris corrected. You give her a gift, she gives you one. The most precious gift a woman has.
She'd know she was being bought.
He'd seen enough of Donna to flash on that. Donna would make out the shuck right off. Cocaine is an aphrodisiac, Barris muttered half to himself. He was setting up the testing equipment beside Bob Arctor's cephalochromoscope, which was Bob's most expensive possession. After she snorted a good part of it, she'll be happy to uncork herself.
Shit, man,
Charles Freck protested.
You're talking about Bob Arctor's girl. He's my friend. and a guy that you and Luckman live with.
Barris momentarily raised his shaggy head. He scrutinized Charles Freck for a time. "There's a great deal about Bob Arctor you're not aware of," he said, "that none of us are. Your view is simplistic and naive, and you believe about him what he wants you to."
"Oh, he's an all right guy."
"Certainly," Barris said, nodding and grinning. "Beyond a doubt, one of the world's best. But I have come, we have come, those of us who have observed Arctor acutely and perceptively, to distinguish in him certain contradictions, both in terms of personality structure and in behavior, in his total relatedness to life, in, so to speak, his innate style."
"Do you have anything specific?"
Barris's eyes behind his green shades danced.
"Your eyes dance and don't mean nothing to me," Charles Freck said. "What's wrong with the cephoscope that you're working on it?"
He moved in closer to look for himself. Tilting the central chassis on end, Barris said, "Tell me what you observe there with the wiring underneath."
I see cut wires," Charles Freck said, "and a bunch of what look like deliberate shorts. Who did it?"
Still, Barris's merry, knowing eyes danced with special delight.
"This crummy, significant crud doesn't go down with me worth shit," Charles Freck said. "Who damaged this cephoscope? When did it happen? Did you just find out recently? Arctor didn't say anything the last time I saw him, which was the day before yesterday."
Barris said, "Perhaps he wasn't prepared to talk about it yet."
"Well," Charles Freck said, "as far as I'm concerned, you're talking in spaced-out riddles. I think I'll go over to one of the new PATH residences and turn myself in and go through withdrawal cold turkey and get therapy, the destruct game they play, and be with those guys day and night and not have to be around mysterious nuts like yourself that don't make sense and I can't understand. I can see this cephoscope's been fucked over, but you're not telling me anything. Are you trying to allege that Bob Arctor did it to his own expensive equipment, or are you not? What are you saying?" "I wish I was living over at New PATH, where I wouldn't have to go through this meaningful shit I don't dig day after day. If not with you, then with some burned-out freak like you, equally spaced." He glared.
"I did not damage this transmitting unit," Barris said speculatively, his whiskers twitching. "And doubt seriously that Ernie Luckman did."
"I doubt seriously if Ernie Luckman ever damaged anything in his life, except that time he flipped out on bad acid and threw the living room coffee table and everything else besides out through the window of that apartment they had, him and that Joan chick, onto the parking area. That's different. Normally Ernie's got it all together more than the rest of us. No, Ernie wouldn't sabotage somebody else's cephoscope. And Bob Arctor, it's his, isn't it? What'd he do? Get up secretly in the middle of the night without his knowledge and do this? Burn himself like this? No, this was done by somebody out to burn him. That's what this was." "You probably did it, you gungy motherfucker," he thought. "You got the technical know-how, and your mind's weird. The person that did this," he said, "ought to be either in a federal neural aphasia clinic or the Marble Orchard. Preferably, in my opinion, the latter. Bob always really got off on this Altec cephoscope. I must have seen him put it on every time as soon as he gets home from work at night. As soon as he steps in the door. Every guy has one thing he treasures. This was his. So I say this is shit to do to him, man. Shit."
"That's what I mean."
What's what you mean?"
"As soon as he gets home from work at night," Barris repeated. "I have been for some time conjecturing as to who Bob Arctor is really employed by, what specific actual organization it is that he can't tell us."
"It's the fucking Blue Chip Redemption Stamp Center in Placentia," Charles Freck said. "He told me once."
"I wonder what he does there." Charles Freck sighed.
"Colors the stamps blue."
He did not like Barris, really. Freck wished he were elsewhere, maybe scoring from the first person he ran into or called.
Maybe I should split, he said to himself, but then he recalled the jar of oil and cocaine cooling in the freezer. $100 worth for 98 cents. Listen, he said, when will that stuff be ready? I think he's shucking me. How can the solar cane people sell it for that little if it has a gram of pure coconut? How can they make a profit?
They buy, Barris declared, in large quantities. In his head, Charles Freck rolled an instant fantasy. Dump trucks full of cocaine, backing up to the solar cane factory, wherever it was, Cleveland, maybe, dumping tons and tons of pure, unstepped-on, uncut, high-grade cocaine into one end of the factory, where it was mixed with oil and inert gas and other garbage, and then stuck in little bright-colored spray cans to be stacked up by the thousands in 7-Eleven stores and drug stores and supermarkets.
What we ought to do, he ruminated, is knock over one of those dump trucks. Take the whole load, maybe 700 or 800 pounds. Hell, lots more. Who is a dump truck hold?
Barris brought him the now empty solar cane spray can for his inspection. He showed him the label on which were listed all the contents.
See? Benzocaine, which only certain gifted people know is a trade name for cocaine. If they said cocaine on the label, people would flash on it, and they'd eventually do what I do. People just don't have the education to realize. The scientific training, such as I went through.
What are you going to do with this knowledge? Charles Freck asked. Besides making Donna Hawthorne horny.
I plan to write a bestseller, eventually, Barris said. A text for the average person about how to manufacture safe dope in his kitchen without breaking the law. You see, this does not break the law. Benzocaine is legal. I found a pharmacy and asked them. It's in a lot of things.
Hey, Charles Freck said, impressed.
He examined his wristwatch to see how much longer they had to wait. Bob Arctor had been told by Hank, who was Mr. F., to check out the local New Path residence centers in order to locate a major dealer, whom he had been watching, but who had abruptly dropped from sight. Now and then, a dealer, realizing he was about to be busted, took refuge in one of the drug rehabilitation places, like Synanon and Centerpoint and Excalay and New Path, posing as an addict seeking help. Once inside, his wallet, his name, everything that identified him, was stripped away in preparation for building up a new personality, not drug-oriented. In this stripping-away process, much that the law enforcement people needed in order to locate their suspect disappeared. Then, later on, when the pressure was off, the dealer emerged and resumed his usual activity outside. How often this happened, nobody knew. The drug rehab outfits tried to discern when they were being so used, but not always successfully. A dealer in fear of 40 years imprisonment had motivation to spin a good story to the rehab staff that had the power to admit or refuse him. His agony at that point was mainly real. Driving slowly up Catella Boulevard, Bob Arctor searched for the New Path sign in the wooden building, formerly a private dwelling, that the energetic rehab people operated in this area. He did not enjoy shucking his way into a rehab place, posing as a prospective resident in need of help, but this was the only way to do it. If he identified himself as a narcotics agent in search of somebody, the rehab people, most of them usually, anyhow, would begin evasive action as a matter of course. They did not want their family hassled by the man, and he could get his head into that space, appreciate the validity of that. These ex-addicts were supposed to be safe at last. In fact, the rehab staff customarily, officially guaranteed their safety on entering. On the other hand, the dealer he sought was a mother of the first water, and to use the rehab places this way ran contrary to every good interest for everyone. He saw no choice for himself, or for Mr. F., who had originally put him on to Spade Weeks. Weeks had been Arctor's main subject for an interminable time, without result, and now, for 10 whole days, he had been unfindable. He made out the bold sign, parked in that little lot, which this particular branch of New Path shared with the bakery, and walked in an uneven manner up the path to the front door, hands stuffed in his pockets, doing his loaded and miserable number. At least the department didn't hold it against him for losing Spade Weeks. In their estimation, officially, it just proved how slick Weeks was. Technically, Weeks was a runner rather than a dealer. He brought shipments of hard dope up from Mexico at irregular intervals to somewhere short of L.A. where the buyers met and split it up. Wiggs's method of sneaking the shipment across the border was a neat one. He taped it on the underside of the car of some straight type ahead of him at the crossing, then tracked the dude down on the U.S. side and shot him at the first convenient opportunity. If the U.S. Border Patrol discovered the dope taped on the underside of the straight's vehicle, then the straight got sent up, not Weeks. Possession was prima facie in California. Too bad for the straight and his wife and kids. Better than anyone else in Orange County undercover work, he recognized Weeks on sight. Fat black dude in his 30s with a unique, slow, and elegant speech pattern, as if memorized at some phony English school. Actually, Weeks came from the slums of L.A. He'd learned his diction most likely from edutapes loaned by some college library. Weeks liked to dress in a subdued but classy way, as if he were a doctor or a lawyer. Often he carried an expensive alligator hide attaché case and wore horn-rimmed glasses. Also, he was usually armed, with a shotgun for which he had commissioned a custom-made pistol grip from Italy, very posh and stylish. But at New Path, his assorted shucks would have been stripped away. They would have dressed him like everyone else, in random donated clothes, and stuck his attaché case in the closet. Opening the solid wood door, Arctor entered. Gloomy hall, lounge to his left, guys reading, ping-pong table at the far end, then a kitchen. Slogans on the walls, some hand-done and some printed. The only real failure is to fail others, and so forth. Little noise, little activity. New Path maintained assorted retail industries. Probably most of the residents, guys and chicks alike, were at work, at their hair shops and gas stations and ballpoint pen works. He stood there, waiting in a weary way. Yes? A girl appeared, pretty, wearing an extremely short blue cotton skirt and a t-shirt with New Path dyed across it from nipple to nipple. He said in a thick, croaking, humiliated voice, In a bad space. Can't get together anymore. Can I sit down? Sure. The girl waved, and two guys, mediocre in appearance, showed up, looking impassive. Take him where he can sit down and get him some coffee. What a drag, Arctor thought as he let the two guys coerce him to a seedy-looking, overstuffed couch. Dismal walls, he noticed. Dismal, low-quality, donated paint. They subsisted, though, on contributions, difficulty in getting funded. Thanks, he grated shakily, as if it was an overwhelming relief to be there and sit. Wow, he said, attempting to smooth his hair. He made it seem that he couldn't and gave up. The girl directly before him said firmly, You look like hell, mister. Yeah, both guys agreed in a surprisingly snappy tone. Like real shit. What have you been doing, lying in your own crap? Arctor blanked. Who are you? One guy demanded. You can see what he is, the other said. Some scum from the fucking garbage pail. Look. He pointed at Arctor's hair. Lice. That's why you itch, Jack. The girl, calm and above it, but not in any way friendly, said, Why'd you come in here, mister? To himself, Arctor thought, Because you have a big-time runner in here somewhere, and I'm the man, and you're stupid, all of you. But instead he muttered cringingly, which was evidently what was expected. Did you say, Yes, mister, you can have some coffee. The girl jerked her head, and one of the guys obediently strode off to the kitchen. A pause. Then the girl bent down and touched his knee. You feel pretty bad, don't you? She said softly. He could only nod. Shame, and a sense of disgust at the thing you are, she said. Yeah, he agreed. At the pollution you've made of yourself? Cesspool? Sticking that spike up your ass day after day, injecting your body with... I couldn't go on anymore, Arctor said. This place is the only hope I could think of. I had a friend come in here, I think. He said he was going to. Black dude in his 30s. Educated. Very polite. And you'll meet the family later, the girl said. If you qualify. You have to pass our requirements, you realize. And the first one is sincere need. I have that, Arctor said. Sincere need. You've got to be bad off to be let in here.
Why, I am, he said.
How strung out are you? What's your habit up to?
Once a day, Arctor said.
Pure?
Yeah, he nodded. I keep a sugar bowl of it on the table.
It's going to be super rough. You'll gnaw your pillow into feathers all night. There'll be feathers everywhere when you wake up, and you'll have seizures and foam at the mouth, and dirty yourself the way sick animals do. Are you ready for that? You realize we don't give you anything here.
Well, there isn't anything,
he said.
This was a drag, and he felt restless and irritable. My, buddy, he said, the black guy, did he make it here? I sure hope he didn't get picked up by the pigs on the way.
He was so out of it, man. He could hardly navigate. He thought, there are no one-to-one relationships at New Path, the girl said. You'll learn that.
Yeah, but did he make it here? Arctor said.
He could see he was wasting his time.
Jesus, he thought, this is worse than we do downtown, this hassling. And she won't tell me jack shit.
Policy, he realized, like an iron wall. Once you go into one of these places, you're dead to the world. Spade Weeks could be sitting beyond the partition, listening and laughing his ass off, or not be here at all, or anything in between. Even with a warrant, that never worked. The rehab outfits knew how to drag their feet, stall around, until anyone living there sought by the police had zipped out a side door or bolted himself inside the furnace. After all, the staff here were all ex-addicts themselves, and no law enforcement agency liked the idea of rousting a rehab place. The yells from the public never ceased.
Time to give up on Spade Weeks, they decided, and extricate myself. I wonder they never sent me around here before. These guys are not nice.
And then he thought, so, as far as I'm concerned, I've indefinitely lost my main assignment. Spade Weeks no longer exists. I'll report back to Mr. F, he said to himself, and await reassignment. Ah, the hell with it. He rose to his feet stiffly and said, splitting. The two guys had now returned, one of them with a mug of coffee, the other with literature, apparently of an instructional kind.
You're checking me out, the girl said, haughtily, with contempt.
You don't have it at gut level to stick with a decision? To get off the filth? You're going to crawl back out of here on your belly? All three of them glared at him with anger.
Later, Arctor said, and moved toward the front door, the way out.
Fucking doper, the girl said from behind him. No guts, brain fried, nothing. Creep out, creep. It's your decision.
I'll be back, Arctor said, nettled.
The mood here oppressed him, and it had intensified now that he was leaving.
We may not want you back, Gutless, one of the guys said.
You'll have to plead, the other said. You may have to do a lot of heavy pleading, and even then, we may not want you. In fact, we don't want you now, the girl said.
At the door, Arctor paused and turned to face his accusers. He wanted to say something, but for the life of him, he couldn't think of anything. They blanked out his mind. His brain would not function. No thoughts, no response, no answer to them. Even a lousy and feeble one came to him at all. Strange, he thought, and was perplexed. And passed on out of the building to his parked car. As far as I'm concerned, he thought, Spade Weeks has disappeared forever. I ain't going back inside one of those places. Time, he decided queasily, to ask to be reassigned, to go after somebody else. They're tougher than we are.
Chapter 4. From within his scramble suit, a nebulous blur who signed in as Fred faced another nebulous blur representing himself as Hank.
So much for Donna, for Charlie Freck, and let's see. Hank's metallic monotone clicked off for a second. All right, you've covered Jim Barris.
Hank made an annotation on the pad before him.
Doug Weeks, you think, is probably dead or out of this area?
Or hiding in an active, Fred said.
Have you heard anyone mention this name, Earl or Art De Winter?
No.
How about a woman named Molly? Large woman?
No.
How about a pair of spades? Brothers, about 20, named something like Hatfield? Possibly dealing in pound bags of heroin?
Pounds?
Pound bags of heroin? That's right.
No, Fred said. I'd remember that.
A Swedish person, tall, Swedish name, male, served time, wry sense of humor. Big man but thin, carrying a great deal of cash, probably from the split of a shipment earlier this month.
I'll watch for him, Fred said. Pounds. He shook his head, or rather the nebulous blur wobbled.
Hank sorted among his holographic notes. Ah, well, this one is in jail.
He held up a picture briefly,
then read the reverse.
No, this one's dead. They've got the body downstairs.
He sorted on. Time passed.
Do you think the Jorah girl is turning tricks?
I doubt it.
Jorah Kajas was only 15. Strung out on injectable Substance D already, she lived in a slum room in Brea, upstairs, the only heat radiating from a water heater, her source of income a state of California tuition scholarship she had won. She had not attended classes, so far as he knew, in 6 months.
Well, when she does, let me know. Then we can go after the parents.
Okay, Fred nodded.
Boy, the bubblegummers go downhill fast. We had one in here the other day. She looked 50. Wispy gray hair, missing teeth, eyes sunk in, arms like pipe cleaners. We asked her what her age was. She said 19. We double-checked. You know how old you look? This one matron said to her. Look in the mirror. So she looked in the mirror. She started to cry. I asked her how long she'd been shooting up.
A year, Fred said.
4 months.
The street stuff is bad right now,
Fred said, not trying to imagine the girl, 19, with her hair falling out.
Cut with worse garbage than usual.
You know how she got strung out? Her brothers, both of them, who were dealing, went in her bedroom one night, held her down and shot her up, then balled her. Both of them. To break her into her new life, I guess. She'd been on the corner several months when we hauled her in here.
Where are they now? He thought he might run into them.
Serving a 6-month sentence for possession. The girl's also got the clap now and didn't realize it, so it's gone up deep inside her, the way it does. Her brother thought that was funny.
Nice guys, Fred said.
I'll tell you one that'll get you for sure. You're aware of the 3 babies over at Fairfield Hospital that they have to give hits of smack to every day, that are too young to withdraw yet? A nurse tried to...
It gets me, Fred said in his mechanical monotone. I heard enough, thanks.
Hank continued.
When you think of newborn babies being heroin addicts because...
Thanks, the nebulous blur called Fred repeated.
What do you figure the bus should be for a mother that gives a newborn baby a joy pop of heroin to pacify it, to keep it from crying? Overnight in the county farm?
Something like that, Fred said tonelessly. Maybe a weekend like they do the drunks. Sometimes I wish I knew how to go crazy. I forget how.
Well, it's a lost art,
Hank said.
Maybe there's an instruction manual on it.
There was this flick back around 1970, Fred said, called The French Connection, about a 2-man team of heroin narcs. And when they made their hit, one of them went totally bananas and started shooting everyone in sight, including his superiors. Made no difference.
It's maybe better you don't know who I am, then, Hank said. You could only get me by accident.
Somebody, Fred said, will get us all anyhow eventually.
It'll be a relief. A distinct relief.
Going farther into his pile of notes, Hank said,
Jerry Fabin. Well, we'll write him off. NAC. The boys down the hall say Fabin told the responding officers on the way to the clinic that a little contract man 3 feet high, legless, on a cart, had been rolling after him day and night. But he never told anybody, because if he did, they'd freak and get the hell out, and then he'd have no friends. Nobody to talk to.
Yeah, Fred said stoically.
Fabin has had it. I read the EEG analysis from the clinic. We can forget about him.
Whenever he sat facing Hank and did his reporting thing, he experienced a certain deep change in himself. Afterward was when he usually noticed it, although at the time he sensed that, for a reason, he assumed a measured and uninvolved attitude. Whatever came up and whoever it was about possessed no emotional significance to him during these sessions. At first, he had believed it to be the scramble suits that both of them wore. They could not physically sense each other. Later on, he conjectured that the suits made no actual difference. It was the situation itself. Hank, for professional reasons, purposefully played down the usual warmth, the usual arousal in all directions. No anger, no love, no strong emotions of any sort would help either of them. How could intense natural involvement be of any use when they were discussing crimes, serious crimes, committed by persons close to Fred, and even, as in the case of Luckman and Donna, dear to him? He had to neutralize himself. They both did. Him more so than Hank. They became neutral. They spoke in a neutral fashion. They looked neutral. Gradually it became easy to do so, without prearrangement. And then afterward, all his feelings seeped back. Indignation at many of the events he had seen, even horror in retrospect. Shock. Great overpowering runs for which there had been no previews. with the audio always up too loud inside his head. But while he sat across the table from Hank, he felt none of these. Theoretically, he could describe anything he had witnessed in an impassive way, or hear anything from Hank. For example, he could offhandedly say, "Donna is dying of hep and using her needle to wipe out as many of her friends as she can. Best thing here would be to pistol whip her until she knocks it off." His own check. If he had observed that or knew it for a fact. Or, "Donna suffered a massive vasoconstriction from a Mickey Mouse LSD analog the other day and half the blood vessels in her brain shut down." Or, "Donna is dead." And Hank would note that down and maybe say, "Who sold her the stuff and where's it made?" Or, "Where's the funeral, and we should get license numbers and names." And he discussed that without failing. This was Fred. But then later on, Fred evolved into Bob Arctor, somewhere along the sidewalk between the Pizza Hut and the Arco gas station, regular now $1.02 a gallon. And the terrible colors seeped back into him, whether he liked it or not. This change in him as Fred was an economy of the passions. Firemen and doctors and morticians did the same trip in their work. None of them could leap up and exclaim each few moments. They would first wear themselves out and be worthless, and then wear out everyone else, both as technicians on the job and as humans off. An individual had just so much energy. Hank did not force this dispassion on him. He allowed him to be like this, for his own sake. Fred appreciated it. "What about Arctor?" Hank asked. In addition to everyone else, Fred in his scramble suit naturally reported on himself. If he did not, his superior, and through him the whole law enforcement apparatus, would become aware of who Fred was, suit or not. The agency plants would report back, and very soon he, as Bob Arctor, sitting in his living room smoking dope and dropping dope with the other dopers, would find he had a little 3-foot-high contract man on a card coasting after him, too. And he would not be hallucinating, as had been Jerry Fabin. "Arctor's not doing anything much," Fred said, as he always did. "Works at his nowhere blue chip stamp job, drops a few tabs of death, cut with meth during the day." "I'm not sure." Hank fiddled with one particular sheet of paper. "We have a tip here from an informant whose tips generally pan out that Arctor has funds above and beyond what the Blue Chip Redemption Center pays him. We called them and asked them what his take-home pay is. It's not much. And then we inquired into that, why that is, and we found he isn't employed there full-time throughout the week." "No shit," Fred said dismally, realizing that the above-and-beyond funds were, of course, those provided him for his narking. Every week, small-denomination bills were dispensed to him by a machine, masquerading as a Dr. Pepper source at a Mexican bar and restaurant in Placentia. This was, in essence, payoffs on information that he gave that resulted in convictions. Sometimes this sum became exceptionally great, as when a major heroin seizure occurred. Hank read on reflectively. "And according to this informant, Arctor comes and goes mysteriously, especially around sunset. After he arrives home, he eats, then on what may be pretexts, takes off again, sometimes very fast. But he's never gone for long." He glanced up. The scramble suit glanced up at Fred. "Have you observed any of this? Can you verify? Does it amount to anything?"
"Most likely his chick, Donna," Fred said.
"Well, most likely. You're supposed to know."
"It's Donna. He's over there banging her day and night."
He felt acutely uncomfortable. "But I'll check into it and let you know. Who's this informant? Might be a burn toward Arctor." "Oh, hell, we don't know. On the phone. No prints. He used some sort of rinky-dink electronic grid." Hank chuckled. It sounded odd, coming out metallically as it did. "But it worked. Enough."
"Christ," Fred protested. "It's that burned-out acid-head Jim Barris doing a skitsy grudge number on Arctor's head. Barris took endless electronic repair courses in the service, plus heavy machinery maintenance. I wouldn't give him the time of day as an informant."
Hank said, "Well, we don't know it's Barris, and anyhow, there may be more to Barris than burned-out acid head. We've got several people looking into it. Nothing I feel would be of use to you, at least so far."
"Anyhow, it's one of Arctor's friends," Fred said.
"Yes, it's undoubtedly a vengeance burn trip. These dopers, phoning in on each other every time they get sore. As a matter of fact, he did seem to know Arctor from a close standpoint.
Nice guy, Fred said bitterly.
Well, that's how we find out, Hank said. What's the difference between that and what you're doing?
I'm not doing it for a grudge, Fred said.
Why are you doing it, actually?
Fred, after an interval, said, Damned if I know.
You're off weeks. I think for the time being, I'll assign you primarily to observe Bob Arctor. Does he have a middle name? He uses the initial...
Fred made a strangled, robot-like noise. Why Arctor?
Covertly funded? Covertly engaged? Making enemies by his activities? What's Arctor's middle name?
Hank's pen poised patiently. He waited to hear. Postlethwaite.
How do you spell that?
I don't know. I don't fucking know, Fred said.
Postlethwaite, Hank said, writing a few letters. What nationality is that?
Welsh, Fred said curtly. He could barely hear. His ears had blurred out, and one by one his other senses as well.
Are those the people who sing about the men of Harlech? What is Harlech? A town somewhere?
Harlech is where the heroic defense against the Yorkists in 1468. Fred broke off. Shit, he thought. This is terrible.
Wait, I want to get this down, Hank was saying, writing away with his pen.
Fred said, Does this mean you'll be bugging Arctor's house and car?
Yes, with the new holographic system, it's better, and we currently have a number of them unrequisitioned. You'll want storage and printout on everything, I would assume?
Hank noted that, too. I'll take what I can get, Fred said. He felt totally spaced from all this. He wished the debriefing session would end, and he thought, Only I could drop a couple tabs. Across from him, the other formless blur wrote and wrote, filling in all the inventory ident numbers for all the technological gadgetry that would, if approval came through, soon be available to him, by which to set up a constant monitoring system of the latest design, on his own house, on himself. For over an hour, Barris had been attempting to perfect a silencer, made from ordinary household materials costing no more than 11 cents. He had almost done so, with aluminum foil and a piece of foam rubber. In the night darkness of Bob Arctor's backyard, among the heaps of weeds and rubbish, he was preparing to fire his pistol with the homemade silencer on it.
The neighbors will hear, Charles Freck said uneasily.
He could see lit windows all over, many people probably watching TV or rolling joints. Luckman, lounging out of sight but able to watch, said,
They only call in murders in this neighborhood.
Why do you need a silencer?
Charles Freck asked Barris.
I mean, they're illegal.
Barris said moodily, In this day and age, with the kind of degenerate society we live in, and the depravity of the individual, every person of worth needs a gun at all times to protect himself. He half shut his eyes and fired his pistol with its homemade silencer. An enormous report sounded, temporarily deafening the three of them. Dogs in far-off yards barked. Smiling, Barris began unwrapping the aluminum foil from the foam rubber. He appeared to be amused.
Oh, that's, sure some silencer, Charles Freck said, wondering when the police would appear. A whole bunch of cars.
What it did, Barris explained, showing him and Luckman black-seared passages burned through the foam rubber, is augment the sound rather than dampen it. But I almost have it right. I have it in principle, anyhow.
How much is that gun worth? Charles Freck asked.
He'd never owned a gun. Several times he'd owned a knife, but somebody always stole it from him. One time a chick had done that, while he was in the bathroom. Not much, Barris said, about $30 used, which this is. He held it out to Freck, who backed away apprehensively.
I'll sell it to you, Barris said.
You really ought to have one, to guard yourself against those who would harm you.
Well, there's a lot of those, Luckman said in his ironic way with a grin. I saw in the L.A. Times the other day... They're giving away a free transistor radio to those who would harm Freck most successfully.
I'll trade you a BorgWarner TAC for it, Freck said.
Well, that you stole from the guy's garage across the street, Luckman said.
Well, probably the gun stolen, too, Charles Freck said.
Most everything that was worth something was originally ripped off anyhow. It indicated the piece had value.
As a matter of fact, he said, the guy across the street... Ripped the tack off in the first place. Probably changed hands like 15 times. I mean, it's a really cool tack.
How do you know he ripped it off? Luckman asked him.
Well, man, he's got 8 tacks there in his garage, all dangling cut wires. What else would he be doing with them? That many, I mean. Who goes out and buys 8 tacks?
To Barris, Luckman said,
I thought you were busy working on the cephscope. You finished already?
I cannot continually work on that night and day because it is so extensive, Barris said. I've got to knock off. He cut with a complicated pocket knife another section of foam rubber. This one will be totally soundless.
Bob thinks you're at work on the cephscope, Luckman said. He's lying there in his bed in his room, imagining that, while you're out here firing off your pistol. Didn't you agree with Bob that the back rent you owe would be compensated by your...
Like good beer, Barris said, an intricate, painstaking reconstruction of a damaged electronic assembly.
Just fire off the great 11-cent silencer of our times, Luckman said, and belched.
I've had it, Robert Arctor thought. He lay alone in the dim light of his bedroom, on his back, staring grimly at nothing. Under his pillow he had his .32 police special revolver. At the sound of Barris's .22 being fired in the backyard, he had reflexively gotten his own gun from beneath the bed and placed it within easier reach. A safety move, against any and all danger. He hadn't even thought it out consciously. But his .32 under his pillow wouldn't be much good against anything so indirect as sabotage of his most precious and expensive possession. As soon as he had gotten home from the debriefing with Hank, he had checked out all the other appliances and found them okay, especially the car. Always the car first, in a situation like this. Whatever was going on, whoever it was by, it was going to be chicken shit and devious. Some freak without integrity or guts lurking on the periphery of his life, taking indirect pot shots at him from a position of concealed safety. Not a person, but more a sort of walking, hiding symptom of their way of life. There had been a time, once, when he had not lived like this, a .32 under his pillow, a lunatic in the backyard firing off a pistol for God knew what purpose, some other nut, or perhaps the same one imposing a brain print of his own shorted out upstairs on an incredibly expensive and valued cephscope that everyone in the house, plus all their friends, loved and enjoyed. In former days, Bob Arctor had run his affairs differently. There had been a wife, much like other wives, 2 small daughters, a stable household that got swept and cleaned and emptied out daily. The dead newspapers not even opened, carried from the front walk to the garbage pail, or even, sometimes, read. But then one day, while lifting out an electric corn popper from under the sink, Arctor had hit his head on the corner of a kitchen cabinet directly above him. The pain, the cut in his scalp, so unexpected and undeserved, had for some reason cleared away the cobwebs. It flashed on him instantly that he didn't hate the kitchen cabinet. He hated his wife, his 2 daughters, his whole house, the backyard with its power mower, the garage, the radiant heating system, the front yard, the fence, the whole fucking place, and everyone in it. He wanted a divorce. He wanted to split. And so he had, very soon, and entered by degrees a new and somber life, lacking all of that. Probably he should have regretted his decision. He had not. That life had been one without excitement, with no adventure. It had been too safe. All the elements that made it up were right there before his eyes, and nothing new could ever be expected. It was like, he had once thought, a little plastic boat that would sail on forever without incident until it finally sank, which would be a secret relief to all. But in this dark world where he now dwelt, ugly things and surprising things, and once in a long while a tiny, wondrous thing spilled out at him constantly, he could count on nothing. Like the deliberate evil damage to his Altec cephalochromoscope, around which he had built the pleasure part of his schedule, the segment of the day in which they all relaxed and got mellow. For someone to damage that made no sense, viewed rationally. But not much among these long, dark evening shadows here was truly rational, at least in the strict sense. The enigmatic act could have been done by anyone, for almost any reason, by any person he knew or had ever encountered. Any one of 8 dozen weirdheads, assorted freaks, burned-out dopers, psychotic paranoids with hallucinatory grudges acted out in reality, not fantasy. Somebody, in fact, he'd never met, who'd picked him at random from the phone book. Or his closest friend. Maybe Jerry Fabin, he thought, before they carted him off.
There was a burned-out poisoned husk. Him and his billions of aphids, blaming Donna. Blaming all chicks, in fact, for contaminating him. The queer. But, he thought, if Jerry had gone out to get anybody, it'd have been Donna, not me. He thought, and I doubt if Jerry could figure out how to remove the bonnet plate from the unit. He might try, but he'd still be there now, screwing and unscrewing the same screw. Or he'd try to get the plate off with a hammer. Anyhow, if Jerry Fabian had done it, the unit would be full of bug eggs that dropped off him. Inside his head, Bob Arctor grinned wryly. Poor fucker, he thought, and his inner grin departed. Poor nowhere mother. Once the trace amounts of complex heavy metals got carried to his brain, well, that was it. One more in a long line, a dreary entity among many others like him, an almost endless number of brain-damaged retards. Biological life goes on, he thought, but the soul, the mind, everything else is dead. A reflex machine, like some insect. Repeating doomed patterns, a single pattern, over and over now. Appropriate or not. Wonder what he used to be like, he mused. He had not known Jerry that long. Charles Freck claimed that once Jerry had functioned fairly well. I'd have to see that, Arctor thought, to believe it. Maybe I should tell Hank about the sabotage of my Cephscope, he thought. They'd know immediately what it implies. What can they do for me anyhow? This is the risk you run when you do this kind of work. It isn't worth it, this work, he thought. There isn't that much money on the fucking planet. But it wasn't the money anyhow. How come you do this stuff? Hank had asked him. Well, what did any man, doing any kind of work, know about his actual motives? Boredom, maybe? The desire for a little action. Secret hostility toward every person around him, all his friends, even toward chicks. Or a horrible positive reason. To have watched a human being you loved deeply, that you'd gotten real close to, held and slept with and kissed and worried about and befriended and most of all admired. To see that warm living person burn out from the inside, burn from the heart outward, until it clicked and clacked like an insect, repeating one sentence again and again. A recording. A closed loop of tape. I know if I just had another hit. I'd be okay, he thought. And still saying that, like Jerry Fabian, when three-quarters of the brain was mush. I know, if I just had another hit, that my brain would repair itself. He had a flash, then. Jerry Fabian's brain is the fucked-over wiring of the cephalochromoscope. Wires cut, shorts. Wires twisted, parts overloaded and no good, line surges, smoke, and a bad smell. And somebody sitting there with a voltmeter tracing the circuit and muttering, my, my, a lot of resistors and condensers need to be replaced, and so forth. And then finally from Jerry Fabian would come only a 60-cycle hum, and they'd give up. And in Bob Arctor's living room, his $1,000 custom-quality Cephscope, crafted by Altec Wood after supposedly being repaired, cast onto the wall in dull gray on one small spot. I know if I just had another hit. After that, they'd throw the Cephscope, damaged beyond repair, and Jerry Fabian, damaged beyond repair, into the same ash can. Oh well, he thought, who needs Jerry Fabian? Except maybe Jerry Fabian, who had once envisioned designing and building a 9-foot-long quad and TV console system as a present for a friend. And when asked how he would get it from his garage to the friend's house, it being so huge when built and weighing so much, he replied, oh, no problem, man. I'll just fold it up. I got the hinges bought already. Fold it up, see? Fold the whole thing up and put it in an envelope and mail it to him. Anyhow, Bob Arctor thought, we won't have to keep sweeping aphids out of the house after Jerry's been by to visit. He felt like laughing, thinking about it. They had, once, invented a routine, mostly Luckman had because he was good at that, funny and clever, about a psychiatric explanation for Jerry's aphid trip. It had to do, naturally, with Jerry Fabian as a small child. Jerry Fabian, see, comes home from first grade one day, with his little books under his arm, whistling merrily, and there, sitting in the dining room beside his mother, is this great aphid, about 4 feet high. His mother is gazing at it fondly. What's happening? Little Jerry Fabian inquires.
This here is your older brother, his mother says, who you've never met before. He's come to live with us. I like him better than you. He can do a lot of things you can't.
And from then on, Jerry Fabian's mother and father continually compare him unfavorably with his older brother, who is an aphid. As the two of them grow up, Jerry progressively gets more and more of an inferiority complex, naturally. After high school, his brother receives a scholarship to college, while Jerry goes to work in a gas station. After that, this brother, the aphid, becomes a famous doctor or scientist. He wins the Nobel Prize. Jerry is still rotating tires at the gas station, earning $1.50 an hour. His mother and father never cease reminding him of this. They keep saying, "If only you could have turned out like your brother." Finally, Jerry runs away from home, but he still subconsciously believes aphids to be superior to him. At first he imagines he is safe, but then he starts seeing aphids everywhere in his hair and around the house because his inferiority complex has turned into some kind of sexual guilt, and the aphids are a punishment he inflicts on himself, etc. It did not seem funny now. Now that Jerry had been lugged off in the middle of the night at the request of his own friends, they themselves, all of them present with Jerry that night, had decided to do it. It couldn't be either postponed or avoided. Jerry, that night, had piled every goddamn object in his house against the front door, like maybe 900 pounds of assorted crap, including couches and chairs and a refrigerator and TV set, and then told everybody that a giant, super-intelligent aphid from another planet was out there preparing to break in and get him. And more would be landing later on, even if he got this one. These extraterrestrial aphids were smarter by far than any humans, and would come directly through the walls, if necessary, revealing their actual secret powers in such ways. To save himself as long as possible, he had to flood the house with cyanide gas, which he was prepared to do. How was he prepared to do this? He had already taped all the windows and doors airtight. He then proposed to turn on the water faucets in the kitchen and bathroom, flooding the house, saying that the hot water tank in the garage was filled with cyanide, not water. He had known this for a long time and was saving it for last, as a final defense. They would all die themselves, but at least it would keep the superintelligent aphids out. His friends phoned the police, and the police broke down the front door and dragged Jerry off to the NA clinic. The last thing Jerry said to them all was, "Bring my things later on. Bring my new jacket with the beads on the back." He had just bought it. He liked it a lot. It was about all he liked anymore. He considered everything else he owned contaminated. No, Bob Arctor thought, it doesn't seem funny now. And he wondered why it ever had. Maybe it had stemmed from fear, the dreadful fear they had all felt during the last weeks being around Jerry. Sometimes in the night, Jerry had told them, he prowled his house with a shotgun, sensing the presence of an enemy, preparing to shoot first, before being shot. That is, both of them. And now, Bob Arctor thought, I've got an enemy. Or anyhow, I've come onto his trail, signs of him. Another slushed creep in his final stages like Jerry. And when the final stages of that shit hits, he thought, it really does hit. Better than any special Ford or GM ever sponsored on primetime TV. A knock at his bedroom door. Touching the gun beneath his pillow, he said, "Yeah?" "Mumble, mumble," Barris's voice. "Come in," Arctor said. He reached to snap on a bedside lamp. Barris entered, eyes twinkling. "Still awake?" "A dream woke me," Arctor said. "A religious dream. In it there was this huge clap of thunder, and all of a sudden the heavens rolled aside and God appeared, and his voice rumbled at me. What the hell did he say? Oh, yeah. 'I am vexed with you, my son,' he said. And he was scowling. I was shaking in the dream and looking up, and I said, 'What do I do now, Lord?' And he said, 'You left the cap off the toothpaste tube again.' And then I realized it was my ex-wife." Seating himself, Barris placed a hand on each of his leather-covered knees, smoothed himself, shook his head, and confronted Arctor. He seemed in an extremely good mood. "Well," he said briskly,
I've got an initial theoretical view as to who might have systematically damaged, with malice, your cephscope, and may do it again.
If you're going to say it was Luckman.
Listen, Barris said, rocking back and forth in agitation.
What if I told you I've anticipated for weeks a serious malfunction in one of the household appliances, especially an expensive one, difficult to repair? My theory called for this to happen. This is a confirmation of my overall theory.
Arctor eyed him. Slowly sinking back down, Barris resumed his calm and bright smiling.
You, he said, pointing. You think I did it? Arctor said. Screwed up my own cephscope with no insurance.
Disgust and rage swelled through him, and it was late at night. He needed his sleep.
No, Barris said rapidly, looking distressed. You are looking at the person who did it. Buggered your cephscope. That was my complete intended statement, which I was not allowed to utter.
You did it. Mystified, he stared at Barris, whose eyes were murky with a sort of dim triumph.
Why?
I mean, it's my theory that I did it, Barris said. Under post-hypnotic suggestion, evidently, with an amnesia block, so I wouldn't remember. He began to laugh.
Later, Arctor said, and snapped off his bedside lamp. Much later.
Barris rose, dithering.
Hey, but don't you see? I've got the advanced, specialized electronic technical skills, and I have access to it. I live here. What I can't figure out, though, is my motive.
You did it 'cause you're nuts, Arctor said. Maybe I was hired by secret forces, Barris muttered in perplexity.
But what would their motives be?
Possibly to start suspicion and trouble among us, to cause dissension to break out, causing us to be pitted against one another, all of us, uncertain of whom we can trust. Who is our enemy, and like that?
And they've succeeded, Arctor said.
But why would they want to do that? Barris was saying as he moved toward the door, his hands flapped urgently. So much trouble, removing that plate on the bottom, getting a passkey to the front door.
I'll be glad, Bob Arctor thought, when we get in the holo scanners and have them set up all over this house. He touched his gun, felt reassured, then wondered if he should make certain it was still full of shells. But then he realized, I wonder if the firing pin is gone or if the powder has been removed from the shells and so forth, and on obsessively, like a little boy counting cracks in the sidewalk to reduce his fear. Little Bobby Arctor, coming home from the first grade with his little school books, frightened at the unknown lying ahead. Reaching down, he fumbled at the bed frame, along and along until his fingers touched scotch tape. Pulling it loose, he tore from it, with Barris still in the room and watching, two tabs of Substance D mixed with quack. Lifting them to his mouth, he tossed them down his throat without water and then lay back, sighing.
Get lost, he said to Barris, and slept.